Thanks. And now we're going to turn it back to the audience for some Q&A.
So I'll start out with a question from Robert Navin. And it's kind of a clarifying question that could go to either one of you, Dan or Richard. And it's, what is the definition of smallholder in Zambia? And then a follow-on question, what was the ratio of increased hectareage over time by smallholders versus large-scale ex-Zimbabwe white farmers? And was animal traction or mechanized plowing enriching used? So pretty specific, but kind of getting into the studies a little bit more.
Sorry, what was the first question again?
The first question is, what is the definition of smallholder in Zambia?
If I can jump in, because I want to take the easy ones and let Dan handle the hard one. Large farmers no longer grow maize, and haven't for quite a while. And the reason for that is because of the FR. I didn't get into it, and it's complicated to explain, but basically because of the FRA input subsidy scheme, buying scheme, it's created distortions in the prices that wholesalers and processors are willing to pay for maize, especially because sometimes, as I alluded to, the government dumps the maize at lower prices, and it's made it basically impossible for large farmers to compete, okay? And so they don't. They grow other things. They tend to grow other cash crops like tobacco or cotton or other things. The animal traction issue is quite interesting, particularly in southern province. There are tsetse fly and other problems, and at least when I was there, a lot of the animal stock has been wiped out. So not only are they not using tractors, they're not even using animal traction because it often takes them several years to be able to put together enough money again to buy a pair of oxen. And so you actually have farmers growing a hectare or two or three using hand hoeing. It's pretty basic. So mechanization is basically not being used, certainly not in the southern province, for maize. There is some animal traction, and there is a surprisingly large amount of hand hoeing left. Defining smallholder, I am going to pass that. I will answer it if Dan doesn't want to, but it's a very complicated definition in Zambia.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be able to tell you what the government's definition, the Zambian government's definition is offhand. On the current project, I'm not sure what the specific definition was on the previous project, but in the current project, it's 2 hectares or less.
Well, I guess just then to amplify it, it does tend to be 2 hectares or less, but as I alluded to, the reason it gets really tricky in Zambia is because you can have farmers that have a fair bit of land, but they don't cultivate it or it's not very good land. And then you can have farmers who have really good land that's close to the market, even if it's only a hectare or two, and are obviously doing commercial. So the standard definition has been small is less than 5 by the government, and then emerging is 5 to 10, and bigger than that is considered a large farmer. But those land sizes don't really correspond to what you would like to think of as more commercial. Are they subsistence or even not subsistence? Are they not barely? Are they food insecure? Are they subsistence? And if they have a good year, they sell some, or are they primary orienting to the market? And I suspect Michigan State has some numbers on that, but I haven't seen those numbers. And I think that's the right question. And there's only a loose correlation between that, the answer to that question, and actually the amount of land they own.
Yeah, because the current project works within field crops, but also within vegetables. And unsurprisingly, our vegetable farmers who are producing on maybe 2,000 square meters closer to Lusaka have by far the highest revenues of, you know, on average of the farmers in the program that are relative to those that are growing field crops across 2 or 3 hectares. So, yeah, I think it's at best a very imperfect proxy, particularly when you're dealing with farming populations who have a wide range of options commercially of what they could be growing.
Dan, you talked about what I presume was the early days of the Profit Project, when there was a good amount of analysis, kind of looking at the endogenous, kind of what was happening on the ground, and using that as the basis for their design. How did they approach the challenge of basically the tension between that approach and then kind of the common challenge of having indicators that were short-term oriented and kind of pushing them in a particular sort of fast results direction. Did they have the benefit of a more enlightened design, or did they sort of do things in parallel so that they were kind of trying to hit earlier indicators that were put into the project for year one, or how did they approach that tension?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a common problem that we run into with, you know, just trying to figure out how you're going to smooth out the implementation versus results time frame over the course of these projects. I mean, this was only one set of activities within a much larger portfolio of other value chains that deployed a wider range of activities. And my sense from looking back, you know, it's always hard to do. I wasn't there, but my sense of looking back was that there were still a lot more direct activities going on within these communities in terms of training and other things. But in terms of what they were doing on the input supply side, that bought them some time in terms of waiting to see what would happen to the rest of this.
If I can answer a slightly different version of that question, I want to come back to one of the last points Dan made on his slides, which is the importance of a flexible approach. To foreshadow what I think is going to be the conclusion of the five studies that we're doing, even though we've only done two, is that because I know some of the other projects, some of the other cases a little bit, one of the very strong recommendations I think we're going to be making is that USAID really needs to move to a very different way of designing its procurements, its contracting, and particularly its monitoring and evaluation, away from here's this amount of money, we want to see this number of farmers and these crops in this number of years. And here are the activities to, we want you to work in this sector, and the overall goals are to move the numbers up on farmers' productivity, malnutrition, food security, et cetera, but how you do that, we are going to renegotiate with you every year based on, to use Dan's metaphor, what the constraints are, what the waves, the riptides look like. See, I think if we stick to the here's the top of the mountain and we've plotted out the path, well, I've done it. I used to do a lot of backpacking. I used to get lost all the time. Okay. I was always finding that I was always off trail, and then I'd have to take a compass reading and try to figure out where I was and have to plot a new course. And what we're seeing, I like to call it the virtuous spiral approach, which is, okay, we want to go from whatever the numbers are, 10,000 farmers use hybrid maize to 30 or 40 or 50. What are the constraints from that happening? Well, right now there are no agri-dealers. Okay, so how can we make a profit for agri-dealers or these agents to do that? Well, that gets us only so far, but then we discover maybe there's not enough breeder seed or foundation seed. So now, or the seed they're using is crappy because the certification system doesn't work very well. So now we have to work on the certification system. Well, okay, we get that going, but now there's not enough credit for enough farmers to buy that. So now we have to work on credit instruments. And the case I'm kind of implicitly describing, or two cases actually, is the economic growth project, which was actually in French, Projet Croissance Économique, in Senegal, which did exactly that. And I think the most important thing you can take away from that is that the Senegal mission worked very closely with the implementing partner. They sat down every year and say, what are the constraints from us moving forward? And they changed substantially the work plan and the intermediate objectives every year. And we're about to do a study of the Bangladesh CISA-MI project, which was a mechanization project, and the same thing. The project initially targeted maize and wheat farmers. They brought in a bunch of machinery services, and the people who adopted them were rice farmers, fish farmers, and horticulture farmers. And rather than say, okay, we have to stick to our plan, and we don't care all these market results that you got that looked really promising. We're going to force you to focus on meat and ways and ram it down their throats, whether they like it or not, whether it's profitable or not, whether the commercial sector is responding or not. No, we're going to take the feedback from the market. If the market says rice, fish, and horticulture, let's go in that direction. If the market liked these two machines but not those two machines, we're going to go in that direction. And that's what the mission did. Now, I think these are extraordinary. I mean, if you've worked with people in USAID missions, many of them are extraordinary. But particularly in these two cases, really the flexibility and the willingness not to sort of just have that sort of Soviet-style central planning mentality. I sometimes joke that USAID contracts are the last Soviet systems on the planet. Again, I do not speak for the agency on that one. You know, our contracting mechanisms need to reflect the market approach that we are talking about implementing. And that means responding flexibly to the feedback we get from farmers and other parts of the value chain about what's working and not, as opposed to, you know, we're the experts, we have the solution, we know the objectives, we have, you know, 5-year goals, and we're going to get there no matter what the market says.
Question is from Simon Winter, and he is interested in how carefully and purposefully the partnerships between government, donors, and the private sector in the studies that you looked at were structured, or were the various stakeholders working independently and incidentally? So he would just like to hear more about that.
In the profit case, the partnerships, I mean, the profit project was working with the Ministry of Agriculture in everything that it was working on, in the sort of standard standard coordination that you would find for a project like that. But the partnerships with the private sector were very intentionally designed. I mean, they were all structured around MOUs and grants. Some of them were grants, some of them weren't grants. Some of them were just an agreement to help design a partnership and help them think through some issues. And so my sense was that at the margin, obviously there's a reason why we tend to try to push to formalize these things, particularly if we have to end up capturing results coming out of them from the private sector partner. But again, that I think there's a value to parsimony in those things too. Only formalize it to the extent necessary, and then that gives you flexibility as you're moving forward.
So in the case that I looked at, the donor role was pretty much confined to CIMMYT's partnerships with both the private sector companies on the one hand, and they continue to work with the national research institutes that do breeding in Zambia and develop maize, though because of the strong private sector presence, the public sector role is much less than it is in other countries. And I want to highlight that. I think, as Dan said, you know, it's a contextual thing. I think you'd have to search pretty far and wide to find more than another 2 or 3 countries in Africa, for sure, sub-Saharan Africa, that have seed sectors that look anywhere close to the strength of the Zambian seed sector. And so in this case, CIMMYT was able to work closely, but only on the breeding, you know, and research, and the seed companies took the baton from there and did all the legwork in terms of marketing and distribution and sales. In countries where the seed sector doesn't look like that, we've seen that the CG institutions, not just CIMMYT, but others, have really struggled because they tend, at least historically, not to be very good at commercialization, or they tend to only work with the national research institution partners, and it is the demo project solution, and we've seen in the past that in the vast majority of cases, demo projects are not sufficient to get you to critical mass and scale. They may be necessary, but they're not sufficient, and so I think that's sort of the Zambian case may kind of be an exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, and I'd highlight as well that we're talking about the maize market because it's dominated by hybrids. You move into any of the other key crops like soy or groundnut, you still run into a massive problem. Any OPV, the market is just much harder from a seed production standpoint to make work. And consistently, and obviously this isn't just Zambia, but there's every year, particularly years after there's been a particularly bumper grain crop, so farmers are not holding back as much, you have a chronic seed shortage within soy and groundnut and any other OPV as well. So I think in terms of thinking through the challenges and the market dynamics of how do we make a private sector seed system work, how do we link these research programs around improving germplasm to an actual commercial distribution scheme within OPV dominant crops, that's a totally different and much more challenging question, and I think is probably going to require a lot more public sector investment down chain for a lot longer until we can figure out how that works.
If I can just pick up on the OPV question, because it is extremely critical, I think there's been a presumption in our sector, in agriculture, that the advantage of OPVs is farmers don't have to buy them every year, and then you just sort of get them out there, and then they just let them rip, and the farmers just use the stuff over and over again. The problem with that is that, especially smaller and semi-literate or illiterate farmers in more remote areas, do not really understand how to select seeds from the OPVs they're growing. And so even though genetically, so to speak, the material may not be deteriorating in quality the way a hybrid will sort of start to revert to its parent lines, over years de facto because they don't know how to, they aren't selecting good seeds. 2, 3, 4 years later, you're basically growing grain and or whatever the plant may, the product may be. And you know what we've seen in a number of other countries, again, I just was back from Senegal, that the major thing, the OPVs that were put in place were put in the mid-90s, but by the mid-2000s, they were growing crap. And the major intervention was to put in a very strong and very solid certified seed system. And the farmers are buying the certified OPVs in rice because they are so much more productive. So this is, I think, a critical thing. And as Dan said, this is something that often the very weak public sector systems have a hard time doing. And I think this is a perfect example where public-private partnerships, we're getting the private sector heavily involved in seed production and seed processing and certification can be quite critical.
I'm Ann Steensland with the Global Harvest Initiative. I just got back from Zambia. I was in the Northwestern province traveling with some major input suppliers, visiting smallholder farmers. And one of the folks who run the programs for these input suppliers trying to develop these markets, one of their immediate concerns right now is where we are in the global agricultural business cycle. And they're getting a lot more pressure to increase their profit margins from smallholder farmers. And there is less tolerance internally for a long-term investment in smallholder farmers. So their concern is that over time, they're going to be asked to cut back and pull in some costs, and maybe they're going to have to focus most of their efforts on that emerging scale, the 5 to 20 hectares, or the folks who are, you know, maybe that 2 to 5 hectares closer to major roads. So some of the places where we were in the Northwestern province, it's just not going to internally make sense given the new requirements they're being faced in terms of producing profits. So I don't know if you encountered any of that, but I'd be curious to know what impact you think that might have on some of the programs that you're running in Zambia or elsewhere.
That core question of geography that Richard talked about, I mean, it's more profound than just the input access, right? I mean, this you're talking about just objective levels of poverty increasing the further out from these major roadways that you get, and that's, I mean, it's not hard to understand the feedback loops between the distance from transport, distance from many, not just markets, but other public services tend to be less, you know, more politically marginalized the further away from these roadways you are. So I think that is just a core issue. I mean, what I think is really important to not forget, particularly from the donor side or an implementer in this project in partnership with these companies, is that the transaction costs due to distance and due to the quality of the roadways are beyond your ambit and they're beyond the ambit of the company to fix. And so the first thing that you should be doing when you're trying to figure out whether or not, you know, if you're going to start trying to work out a partnership over the long term with some of these larger companies, both buyers or input suppliers, is you need to run the numbers on what that's actually going to look like for them to supply, both in terms of time, logistics, fuel, staff, trucks. It's very easy for those costs alone to overwhelm the business case for them to actually expand into these areas. And in that situation, you shouldn't be wasting 5 years of your project beating your head against a wall. You should be bringing those results to the government, who is probably working with some sort of larger investment in terms of figuring out what their next 5, 10, 20-year infrastructure development plan is, and say, look, if you guys can extend this road out another 100 kilometers, you know, we can estimate this impact. So I do think there's a lot of ground in terms of trying to link up the value chain approach to some of these larger level, other multilateral investment schemes that do tend to work more on the infrastructure side, and trying to help them figure out how to most efficiently allocate those investment resources based on where we see these market failures that otherwise could be there, could be solved.
If I could pick up on that, I want to repeat and highlight something I said before and extend it, which is, depending upon how profitable this stuff is, as you get 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 kilometers away from these roads, the transaction costs swamp the increased profitability, and basically nobody wants to go there. Mark was kind enough to mention that I've been helping BFS in the Feed the Future program for a while now, and particularly in the case of Tanzania, where they were supporting rice, among other things. I think, again, in terms of how the agency goes forward with this, we really need to change our M&E, which currently the M&E is largely designed to produce accountability for the agency that the implementing partner is achieving its objectives. But it's not designed to create a learning and feedback mechanism so that on an annual work plan basis, missions and their implementing partners can make good decisions and change work plans in reaction to what they're finding out. One of the key things in this was where to scale up the rice that they were introducing. And we didn't have data on where, at what point, how far from the road does the business case flip from a positive to a negative. So how can you decide to scale up if you don't have disaggregated crop budget data, depending upon what kind of yields you're getting, what you're paying for inputs, how much the transaction costs are to get your product to market? And I think what we came up with on some, I'm an expert at back of the envelope calculations. Mark and I have actually huddled over a couple of spreadsheets for 2 days, you know, trying to get some handle on some of these things in several countries. Is that I think you need to, as sort of to build on what Dan said, like a fill-in strategy. Right now it's profitable 20, 30, 40 kilometers, so let's kind of push that envelope. We'd like to think that if there's now enough farmers doing this stuff 20, 30, 40 kilometers from the road, in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, some input suppliers may create a business 30 kilometers away or 40 kilometers away, which would then allow us to move the frontier another 10, 20. So to start to sort of think about this sort of layered or wave or, these are not the right metaphors, but you understand what I'm saying, of as, how can we help the commercial sector fill in as the roads get better, as the population density gets better, as critical mass is achieved so that input suppliers are willing to create businesses further and further out and move with that. But again, that requires an M&E system which is measuring where are the input suppliers? What is the geographic gradient of the business case as you get away from roads and input suppliers and also the market on the output side? And currently, most projects don't do that because they don't have to, and they're not being asked to do that question, and they're asked to being hit quantitative objectives. And then when you look at the numbers, gee, isn't it odd that all the smallholders they work with are within 20 kilometers of the road? You know, when in fact the poor, you know, we ask the question, are there contradictions between commercial approach and smallholders? The answer is no, as long as you're in a place where they can make money, which turns out to exclude vast amounts of rural producers because the transaction costs become too high.
We're going to try to squeeze in two more questions. We'll take a question from the webinar audience and then we'll bring it back to in person.
Okay, this question is from Natalia. And she was wondering if both of you could speak to whether there were any gender assessments in the studies that you looked at and how scaling up maize affected both women and men in Zambia, considering the different accessibility to inputs, land support, et cetera.
So we did, two things. One, the presentation that Jennifer Sepstad did that I said is I mentioned is on microlinks from several years ago did much more explicitly focus on potential gender dynamics between male and female agents and then what that implied for their relationship with female or male farmers. Were there any salient differences? There's some interesting learning that comes out of that, so I'd recommend definitely taking a look at that. We did include some questions which tried to disaggregate some implications there. Particularly at the interview level where we were surveying the farmers, talking with the input suppliers and the agents, you know, asking them about their strategies. Several of them have started developing bifurcated marketing strategies where different branded things are distributed to women versus men depending on what they wanted. And there was one funny anecdote where one of the maize companies was talking about how they were marketing a lot of their vegetable seed towards women and really highlighting the effects that it would have on their children's nutrition. And all of the maize seed marketing was all about how big your maize is going to get, how large your yields are going to be. So there was a lot you could unpack there. But what we ended up finding was that a number of the smallholder farmer, the women smallholder farmers that we talked to, particularly liked the fact that the agents were within their communities, and we did find that particularly within these communities, which tend to be much more geographically constrained for women than men, that expansion of the geographic reach, if you're within, you know, if they're within the village, right, did seem to have an acutely positive effect on them. We didn't find any other, you know, particularly notable differences in terms of how the expansion affected them. Most of the input suppliers and agents had no, you know, they were equally interested in male and female farmers. They didn't report any other differences in their approaches. And so, yeah, I think that was the only really notable thing that we found.
In general, we looked at gender, and I cannot tell you the number of focus group discussions I have with the farmers. I say, so, because there are almost always women present, do you have challenges in particular in adopting or implementing hybrid maize seed that are, you feel have something to do, peculiar to do, I didn't use the word peculiar, but have something to do with, you know, your status as a woman? And by and large, the answer was no. The Zambia is not as heavily affected by HIV as some of the other southern African countries. But in the cases where there were widows present who tended, after I found out, I didn't ask them directly, but found out indirectly that they were HIV widows, that has been a problem. And in general, because women tend to have less access to financial resources, you know, one of the tricky businesses when you're talking about scaling up and adoption is, what does that mean? Okay, are you using hybrid maize seed or not? The answer is usually yes. Are you using it? How many hectares of hybrid maize are you planting? Three. What percentage of that are you planting with hybrid maize versus hybrid maize seed that you saved from last year versus OPVs or traditional varieties that you have? And generally speaking, what you find with the women is that because they have less access to resources, they're planting less. In other words, for the farmer, the question is, will I get my allocation from FISP, which is enough for a hectare, but if I have two or three hectares, do I have the money to buy new seeds for that? And the answer tends to be, for poorer farmers, and because women tend to have less access to resources, the answer is often less of that additional land is being planted with hybrid maize. And also the women in particular suffer from lack of animal traction. So those were the issues that came up. The one thing I should mention is we didn't, Dan and I guess we're trying to be discreet, but the FISP program in particular has been, what is the nice word for corruption? Highly inefficient in many ways. And one of them is the fact that there's a lot of local discretion about who gets access to FISP subsidies. Legally, that I don't believe that both a husband and a wife are allowed to, but in some areas they both got it. And in many cases, the wife would give her FISP allocation to the husband. And then I would be in other places where, even though the women would have their own plot in some cases, I said, well, did you get FISP? Oh, no, that's illegal. We can only get it one person per household, so go figure. I just want to mention something briefly coming back to the seed certification. I forgot to mention that Zambia has an outstanding and extremely well-regarded seed certification system, which was, again, started in the 90s and actually a little bit before. And a lot of the initial money and impetus in TA came from Swedish SIDA. And those buildings and a lot of the equipment, unfortunately, which is now 20 or 30 years old, is still there and still being used. And the private sector has been hugely supportive, because when Zambian seeds are exported to Kenya or Zimbabwe or Malawi or all that, they want people to know that this is first-rate seed. And so in the last recent years, because actually donors have not, neither the government nor the donors have really been supporting the seed certification, the private sector has been helping and buying machines and updating the quality of the things. And one of the markers for this, at least it's the only country I know where it's the case, which probably is just a question of my ignorance, but when agri-dealers receive their maize seed for the year, and if they don't sell it all, they are required to return it to the seed company, and the seed company is required to recertify it for the next year before they can resell it. And at least of the countries I've worked in, I've never heard of that before. I think that gives you a sense of what's going on there.
Take our last in-person question.
You've been mentioning access to inputs throughout all of this, and hybrid seed, hybrid maize, fertilizers, I'm assuming. Sorry. And you did say, too, I'm just coming from Zambia in February. Zambia is really trading space for these productivity gains. I mean, they have a lot of forests they're turning into maize. What sort of things are you doing around, say, increasing the resiliency for those sorts of variabilities in rainfall? So what are you doing, say, around climate-smart agriculture or conservation agriculture? Because they keep dumping on more inputs and more seed, but the yields bump with the rain. So what are you doing about that?
So what are we doing with climate-smart agriculture is what some of that comes down to. When we initiated this study, we were looking specifically at drought-tolerant variety adoption. It's coming along. It's hybrid first, drought-tolerant varieties are following. I think that's where, and now there's research on the heat-tolerant variety, so we can hopefully, through that kind of technology, moderate some of the impact of climate variability. Is it a solution? No. Some of the things we can do, we are trying to do, is just improve farm-level productivity. I mean, that could go some way to boosting yields enough so that farmers don't keep cutting down forests to plant maize. Sometimes it's really basic things. When you do go to rural Zambia, you just simply, how many seeds do you put in a hole, right? I mean, just real easy things that farmers could do differently if they've got the better technologies. They've got fertilizer, they've got seeds that are improved varieties that could help them up their yields more. Right? So there's some practical strategies. Is it going to... are we going to solve all the problems? Probably not. I mean, it depends on, you have a year like this last one where you have an El Nino, the impacts of that are, I mean, it sort of overwhelms the agriculture system. Is that a good enough answer?
Well,
so we've got a couple more. Well,
I want to help Mark out here. I don't need a mic. I'm mic.
Okay.
So it's complicated, and let me say why. First of all, what you picked up on is when we talk about, I'm supposedly have expertise in scaling up. When we talk about scaling, we distinguish what I call from intensive versus extensive. Intensive being higher yields, extensive being more inputs or particularly more land. Most of the scaling in Zambia has, in fact, been extensive. As I mentioned, the productivity yields have been, I wouldn't say low, but 20-30% is not enormous, especially over, let's say, 5 years, whereas the land surface has doubled. Part of that, in my opinion, is, in fact, because FRA has been putting out pretty high prices and also is buying in very rural areas for explicit political reasons. In other words, we can get support in the most rural parts of the country because we buy their maize. So that's complicated. There has been and continues to be a very serious effort in Zambia of conservation agriculture. The Conservation Farmers Union is out there pushing it and a number of other projects. But here's the problem, okay? Remember, if we circle back to the beginning of this whole presentation, particularly the focus of our studies, and I think implicitly, well, Dan will speak for himself, has been focusing on scaling up through commercial pathways because as a donor, or not a donor, but as donors that I work for, we don't have the resources to reach millions and millions of people. So how do we get enough of a critical mass and enough commercial buy-in for that to go to scale? Well, you can see how people make money off of selling hybrid maize, even with the issues we've raised about the distribution networks in rural areas and transaction costs. How do you make money on scaling up conservation agriculture? Okay, and that has been a problem. And the farmers are not that interested. I mean, the ones who've been shown it are interested in it. But the other thing about some of these things is when I'm an economist by training, and I really want to second what Dan said at the very beginning, that you really need to take a multi-sector, multidisciplinary approach. The short answer when people say, well, how do you scale stuff up? I say, hire an anthropologist, okay? Not an agronomist. And the reason for that is even in conservation agriculture, not only do people look at crop budgets, but they really look at risk, and they also look at the demands on their resources, particularly labor. And at least the perception, rightly or wrongly, and my understanding from the experts is wrongly, is that conservation agriculture is much more labor intensive. Okay? That's what the farmers perceive. That's not what the experts tell me, but the farmers perceive. And they are busy. Okay? It's not like these guys are just sitting around during the land prep season saying, geez, I got an extra 6 or 8 hours a day. What? Oh, I could go dig some holes. I could, dig these basins. Okay? And so this notion that we don't understand that it's this top-down, expert technology, agronomist-driven thing as opposed to what are the real challenges that farmers are facing and how do we work with their constraints, whether it's on land, labor, if they're women, intra-household access to resources and decision-making. If you don't understand those things, then you don't look, guys, This seed grows 4 times more. Well, actually, it's only 20% more because all the other things you need to get to 4 times more, you don't have access to. And, well, but what about the labor demands? What about access to inputs? Where am I going to sell this stuff? How is it going to affect, my risk? If I put another $1,000 in inputs and I have a bad season and I go bankrupt, what does that do for me then? Okay, so those are all the questions we need to be asking, and crop budgets just scratch the surface, not to mention the fact that the crop budgets change when you're 30 or 40, 50 kilometers from the input and output market. So a much more sophisticated, nuanced understanding of the quote-unquote calculation. They may be illiterate or enumerate, but these guys know what they're doing, and they are making those calculations in their head about land, labor trade-offs, risk calculations, and we need to really understand what they're decision-making processes, but there's been a revolution in behavioral economics, but as far as I see, it has yet to really reach the ground level on a lot of agricultural projects.
And just really quickly to add on, so just to be clear, I also work as on the follow-on to the Profit Project, but which is implemented by ACDI Voca called Profit Plus. And under that project, we are pursuing a lot of things around this issue. So we've got several field trials looking at intercropping with pigeon pea as a way to try to reduce some of the synthetic input use. But what you're really talking about is what's known as Jevons paradox, where increases in efficiency lead to increases in consumption, in this case of land. And it's been a core problem around, the idea that you can somehow, as farmers start to make more money off of their existing land holdings, constrain the amount of land that they're going to put under production moving forward, when it's now just now starting to make them money, I don't know anyone who's actually managed to sort that out. I mean, you can look at the Brazil case as probably the top case in that. So I think that the real key is going to be figuring out, in the long run, we know that in commercializing in agricultural sectors like the maize market in Zambia, you're going to have pressures on land, putting more land under production. How do you reduce the impact of that land as it's going into production? And that means shifting into more sophisticated and complex cultivation systems, working on some shade-grown agroforestry options. And there's a lot of interesting research going on, and I think hopefully this next year or so we should be getting some really good learning on that we'll be talking about from a project perspective as well.
Okay, just to add a word on that. A lot of the USAID project, Feed the Future projects that I've seen have a strategy to try to help farmers get a high enough increase in productivity on their subsistence grain or their staple grain for them to move into horticulture. And then say that, oh, I'm making so much money in horticulture, I don't need all this extra land and all that. And it's, talk about context dependent. I mean, it really is a complicated calculation. In some cases where they've developed horticulture activities or dairy or other things like that are high money makers, the farmers refuse to get out of maize until they're, or even decrease the amount of maize they're producing. And in other places, the way to get them to increase productivity is actually to go to horticulture first. So what's the right pathway? Is it stable grains and then it's a higher value added stuff like hort and dairy? Or is it hort and dairy, wow, this is so attractive, I can now get out of that? And the answer, unfortunately, is actually it's very context dependent and it really depends.
Thank you again, Richard and Dan, and thank you everyone for attending. Thank you